Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today on Labor Day, we'll examine the state of working and middle-class Americans who, for the last few decades, have seen the American dream recede out of reach for many, while a few wealthy families like the Waltons, the heir to the Walmart fortune, have seen their wealth grow to the extent that just one family has wealth equivalent to the combined total of the bottom 40% of all Americans. Dr. Harley Shaken, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade, joins us. Then we will speak with Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute and principal author of the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. We will discuss his latest report, Unions, Inequality, and Faltering Middle-Class Wages. Then finally, veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzagatti joins us. He is the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. We will discuss his proposal of tying the minimum wage to a maximum wage and how working and middle-class Americans can reverse the erosion of their standard of living and their share of the American pie. And joining us is Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Harley Shaken.
It's very nice to be here.
And on this Labor Day, it's pretty clear that union membership is down and income inequality is up. And it seems to me that in the overall sense, as people celebrate labor and on this day, perhaps most people are thinking of the barbecue more than these political issues. But nevertheless, it seems to me a good time for us to reflect on the extent to which our economy has become a plutonomy and the extent to which our democracy is being captured by an oligarchy. Do you think that we have to start getting real in terms of where we stand, in the sense that it seems that it's about time we recognize that radical changes have happened here in this country, and this is not your father's America or your grandfather's America?
I think it's long overdue to make that recognition. We've seen this creep up on us, but the enormity of the inequality, of the decline for the middle class and of working families more generally, and of the decline of unions is really there. So it's not about time, it's way past time, and there's a great urgency. It's indisputable that union density, the percent of the workers who are in a union, has gone way down from almost a little over a third in the 1950s to a little under 12% today. And there's no question that we are experiencing record income inequality. What we failed to do as a society is bring these two things together. When unions were strong and a much more important part of the workforce, then we not only had record economic growth, let's say from the end of World War II to the mid to late 1970s, but we also had a much more equal society. Wealthy people certainly earned a lot more, but there were limits in part by the fact that you had unions representing not simply their own members, but the interests of working families more generally. The decline of unions is an important contributor to this growth of inequality, and this has very, very bad implications and direct impacts on families today.
And Harley Shaken, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office's office reported last year that the average household income for the nation's top 1% has more than tripled, while middle-class incomes grew by less than 40% between 1979 and 2007. And then you've had the Federal Reserve study indicating how the middle class has lost about 40% of wealth in the last decades. And then you've got the Pew Research Center coming out with a similar report. What does it take in terms of the public consciousness about the growing gap between our mythology of the American dream and the reality of how many people are being denied the American dream?
I think it takes focus and redefining the debate. The statistics are appalling and dramatic, but in a way we've heard them so many times that they seem to drift out of consciousness. Americans are feeling this in their homes, in their insecurity, in their apprehension about what the future might bring. So we feel it, but we place the blame for it for those who are not working or for those who have less than we have, but we view that we're being called to support. I think that's enormously misleading, and it deflects the attention from a vastly more unequal society, which in part is contributing to lower economic growth because the consumption that takes place when millions of working Americans are employed, their wages are increasing, they're buying things. So we are placing the blame in the wrong part, and we are looking at the solution as individual initiative. Of course that's important, but it is not enough to solve this growing gap, which doesn't exist in nature. It reflects policies that have been in place since the Reagan years.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Harley Shaken, who is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor, information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. Well, certainly the idea that it's all about the individual pulling him or herself up by the bootstraps is the refrain that we heard last week at the Republican convention. And there's a lot of people in this country, working Americans, the so-called Reagan Democrats, who, you know, have this aspirational notion that they too can become a millionaire. And of course, there's nothing wrong with the aspirational politics. But there seems to be an enormous denial amongst a lot of Americans about the value of a government. For example, we argue all the time, and the Republicans use this all the time, that we pay too much taxes. Well, we don't pay anything like the rest of the world. And the real argument should be, what do you get back for your taxes? And in other countries, in the social democracies, you get an enormous amount back. You get 6 weeks paid vacation. You get pregnancy leave. You get childcare. You get full health coverage. So my sense is that one of the reasons why American workers are so bad off compared to the rest of the industrial world is that simply they don't know about social democracy and how it works.
Oh, I think the way we frame the debate is profoundly misleading and certainly benefits those at the very top of the income scale, but completely distorts our politics. We've framed for decades now a debate between big government and less government. That's never been the appropriate debate. The appropriate debate is how we can have effective government. And what social democracy is all about is the balance between a market system where markets work and the role only a government can play for where markets don't work, and defining the rules of the game that allow markets to work. So one of the ironies here is the Republicans at their convention are recreating the sensibility of an America that existed in the 1950s, but that was an America of rapid economic growth, of families earning more and advancing the income scale, in part because we had strong unions and an effective government for highways, for schools, for research and development, all of which are areas that the present debate would like to downsize dramatically or turn over to the private sector. An additional irony at this very moment is with our hurricane devastating our southern coast once again, is this really the time to talk about less government? Who exactly built those levees after the last hurricane? Who is handling the rescue effort? This isn't an anomaly. This is an area where government is very necessary. And the notion of concentrating on effective government whatever the size is, and in some areas it means a much larger presence, in some areas perhaps a smaller presence, but to have the debate simply less government makes little sense in a complex, rapidly changing world.
Well, Harley Shaken, it seems to me that there's a great deal of cynicism in what's going on here, because one of the more peculiar speeches at last week's Republican convention was Chris Christie. And one of the things that he said, you know, that we, the Republicans, believe in individual initiative and pulling yourself up by the bootstraps, et cetera. But those Democrats under Obama, they want the government to coddle you. Now, the idea that the American government coddles American citizens is such a preposterous notion that if you really look at the record of where the money goes from people's tax dollars and what the government invests in, most of it's in the military-industrial complex, in agribusiness, and most of which you could argue is kind of right-wing welfare. The only traditional welfare that we have is Social Security, which incidentally pays for itself, and Medicare, which definitely needs reforming. But both of those programs are being attacked by the Republicans. I mean, it's just such a lie to say that the government is all about coddling people. If the average American realized what a bad deal we get compared to the rest of the world, they'd be outraged.
Oh, I very much think they would. And there's sort of a perverse irony that's going on here in last week's Republican convention. The fact that someone like Paul Ryan would pose as a champion of Medicare. If you follow the logic of his philosophy to its appropriate conclusion, you would say we don't need Medicare. Let the market handle it, and you pay for your insurance, and if you can't pay for it, you have an incentive to work harder. That's an argument very few Americans would buy, and because of that, you have someone like Congressman Ryan saying, I will defend Medicare. It's a little bit like Colonel Sanders saying, I will defend chickens. You think the track record isn't really there to do that. You can't have it both ways, and there are important elements of what government has done for working families from the New Deal onward, or even before the New Deal, that are very popular with Americans for the very pragmatic reason they work. Social Security, Medicare, the regulations that came out of the progressive era on food, on many of the other ways in which government plays a very positive role in ensuring that markets work.
Well, the rules for American capitalists, who incidentally are making out like bandits and have been for some time, we've seen from Mitt Romney's taxes, at least what little he's released, how much he pays basically capital gains taxes of 15% and less, and may well have paid less, and that we've seen that the enormous amounts of money that people on Wall Street have been accruing through a system of extracting wealth and concentrating it at the top, and not your old traditional form of American capitalism going back to the robber barons, where they actually produced products and provided jobs. And to me, the debate should be about the changing nature of our capitalism, because, you know, it's unsustainable in the long run to keep extracting wealth and not creating it.
It really is not sustainable in the long run. We have got an extraordinary country which has achieved some unprecedented things in a whole range of areas, but that's because we've had, at key points, effective government, and we've had markets that actually work. And you need both to have an effective market economy. And the fact that we have demonized government to such an extent, and the fact that we have the kind of inequality that we're seeing today, which isn't simply damaging economically, but undermines the very ability to have a democratic society. With vast gaps such as this, and with the ability to pour unlimited money into the political system, you have a very different country than many grew up with, and an impossibility of having the American dream in the way that we've historically known it when it has worked.
But we can look at specific events in history, in recent history, and see the examples of how and where and when we went wrong. For example, you were talking about earlier reforms going back to the Progressive Era. Let's just talk about the reforms that came in after the Great Depression, in particular the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banks from banks. It meant that investment banks couldn't play with their depositors' money. Well, the lobbyist weighed in on Clinton, and he and his team decided, I think in part because the Democrats aren't getting the money that they used to get from the labor unions, because the labor unions have lost so much power and influence over the years, he decided to go after Wall Street money. I don't exactly know what was behind this appalling and apocalyptic decision, but they repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. And then, you know, a decade later, we saw the worst crash since the Great Depression, and we're still, you know, haven't come out from under it, and it may take another decade to even get back to where we were before 2008. So there you have a perfect example of how government can actually protect citizens, and if the lobbyists, because they got the money to buy the politicians, can buy the politicians to free up the hands, or, you know, take the handcuffs off the millionaires and put the handcuffs on the welfare queens, the old Reagan adage. All that propaganda was all inherent in the idea of releasing these creative forces of capitalism, and look what happened. I mean, it's all as clear as day to me.
Well, that what you described is a very damaging and dangerous cycle that we are still in the midst of. There's another dimension of this, which, you know, gets back to the very beginning of the conversation on inequality in strong unions. In the 1950s, when unions were near their peak and when we had enormously successful big business that was largely unionized, we learned an important lesson that highly profitable, successful firms that pay higher wages as a part of that create a virtuous circle. Firms are profitable, workers earn more, the flip side of their wages is buying more, and we have even more successful firms and a rapidly growing economy. This isn't theoretical. This is what happened from the end of World War II until the mid to late 1970s. There was a link, because of strong unions, between rising productivity in industry and rising wages, and all Americans benefited. We have broken that link. Unions are far smaller and weaker at the bargaining table, and the result is a new model that we've seen with Caterpillar Tractor in the last several weeks, where one of the most profitable manufacturing companies in the country that earned $5 billion, close to $5 billion last year, that raised its CEO's salary in many percentage points to $17 million a year, is asking for significant cuts to the wages of their workers, and establishing a pattern that we've seen in other areas as well, which is a profitable, successful company pays less. The problem with that is, if you generalize it, you're gutting purchasing power in the economy, and we have slow growth, and that's certainly painful for workers and their families, but it's also the undoing of the economic success that benefits corporations.
Well, Dr. Holly Shaken, I thank you so much for joining us here today on this Labor Day.
It's always nice to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Holly Shaken, who's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. He studies labor information technology, the organization of work, global economic integration, and trade. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Lawrence Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute.
There's power in the factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lawrence Michel, who's the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He is the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled Unions, Inequality, and Faltering Middle Class Wages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Michel.
Well, thanks for having me, and nice to talk to you again.
And on this Labor Day, Larry Michel, obviously, you know, one tends to do a little bit of hand-wringing about how we're down to, what, 6 or 7% of the private workforce unionized, the public employees' unions are under attack, the Republican platform for the first time ever has come out with incredibly hostile anti-union language against collective bargaining. Any cursory look at the trajectory would indicate that the power of money is overwhelming, or the power of organized money, shall I say, is overwhelming the power of organized people, and particularly organized workers.
Well, let's set the whole context. You know, for 30 years, we've had a middle class that really has not done all that well, even though the economy was rich enough to provide a rapid growth of incomes for everybody. And then the question has to be, why has that occurred? Why has the economy worked so that the fruits of economic growth disproportionately go to the top 1% rather than to the vast majority? And the answer is that there's been a number of policies implemented on behalf of those who have the most wealth and power that steered the economy into, you know, so that the people at the top really benefit. One of the major ways that happened is to allow and to make sure that people lost the ability to get together, to do collective bargaining, to represent themselves with their employers. And that right has eroded, as when people get together to do that, it's very hard to be successful. They can be fired with impunity. And employers have the upper hand more generally for a lot of different reasons. So that's not a good thing, and I don't think most people support losing the ability to band together to represent their own best interests with their employers. This has hurt not only those people who don't have a union anymore or would otherwise have a union, but a strong collective bargaining agreements in occupations and industries in the past used to be able to set a standard that most employers abided by so that people who were not directly part of a collective bargaining agreement also were beneficiaries. And that going away is really hurt a lot of people.
But it seems, though, that not just the organized labor landscape has changed in America radically from the 30s and 40s and 50s and even 60s to the current situation. There seems to have been a change in the attitudes of American capitalists. Now, of course, with the increasing financialization of our economy, more and more of our capitalists are into extracting wealth and not creating it, and by extension, creating jobs. But there's also, I think, a lack of a sense of American social contract. And in many ways, American capitalists and corporate CEOs have used globalization as an excuse, in a sense, to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't pay you guys anything because, you know, the same work can be done in Sri Lanka for a fraction of what you guys can do it for.
Well, it is true that employers have used globalization as a tool against American workers, and that some of our politicians have really facilitated their doing that through various kinds of free trade agreements. But it can also be exaggerated, the power of globalization. There's lots of areas of the economy and hospitals and hotels and restaurants, you know, in retail and supermarkets, all sorts of places that are not in direct competition with anyone from abroad, where the same kind of thing has happened, where employers have gotten the upper hand. So it is a much larger phenomena. Globalization is sometimes sold as the reason. And what's interesting about that is the economics of globalization suggests that it makes us all better off. In fact, it can only make us all better off if the overall gains from trading are shared across the board, because economics teaches us that those people who are put in direct competition with lower-wage workers abroad are going to see their wages lowered. And it's not surprising that that's happened, and there is no effort in this country to make sure that economic growth is broadly shared.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Michel, who's the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He's the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled Unions, Inequality, and Faltering Middle Class Wages. It does seem that in spite of the efforts at the Republican convention for the considerably wealthy Mitt Romney and the fairly wealthy Vice President Paul Ryan to come across as defenders of the middle class, which in many ways was their task, I think, to the American television audience, it seems as if the Obama campaign strategy will focus on the middle class more and more as we get closer to November. In terms of your study, Unions, Inequality, and the Faltering Middle Class and Faltering Middle Class Wages, there have been some alarming statistics that have come out recently from the Federal Reserve and then more recently from the Pew Research Center about how the middle class has been decimated in the last couple of decades, losing a couple of decades of growth and wealth. What's the sense, though, of where the middle class is in terms of its recognizing the political reasons for their demise as opposed to being sort of angry and inchoate? I know it's a vague question, but
let's go over all that ground. It is true that the income of a middle-class family is now lower than it was 10 years ago, and it's not just because of this recession, although that's been really, really hurt people broadly. It's that even in the period under George Bush and the other business cycle from 2000 to 2007, that a typical family's income actually didn't grow over that period. It lost in the recession and never really made up much ground in the recovery. And we need to get to the fundamentals. The fundamentals of this problem are that people's wages, that what they can buy with their paychecks and with the benefits that they are provided from employers, have not been growing for 10 years. And that's true for college graduates. It's true for high school graduates. And people's wages and benefits are not growing in spite of the fact that the economy and what it produces, the output of goods and services per hour worked, has grown substantially. So that is the fundamental matter, the fact that there's been a divergence between the economy being able to provide much higher pay for most workers and the fact that people aren't getting it. Now, why that's happened is what I think, is not sufficiently talked about. And in this election, you hear a lot of discussion of really important issues, how much of the rich are going to pay in taxes or not, you know, and what kind of social insurance system are we going to have? We're going to have a Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Those are all very important, but we're not really talking about what is it that we're going to do to get people jobs, get people good jobs, to make sure that their wages and benefits are rising with productivity. And that doesn't come out in the reports you mentioned. That doesn't really come out in the discussion. I think people understand that. I fear that people believe that what's happening, there's no other choice. I don't believe that to be true. I think that the reason why people's pay doesn't keep up is that we live in an economy that people are very disempowered, where labor standards are very weak. We have young people, college graduates, working in interns for no money whatsoever. We have people at the very bottom, mostly immigrant workers, who sometimes have to fight to get paid for work they've already done, and where's the City Council of Los Angeles, et cetera, moving on legislation to stop wage theft. You know, why do we have to do something like that? It's just because employers are able to ride roughshod over people. It's because we have too much unemployment. It's because there's not enough collective bargaining where people can set, you know, higher standards for themselves and for other workers in their occupation and industry.
Well, Larry Michel, at the Republican convention last week, Paul Ryan made a joke about kids, 20-year-olds, staying at home, watching the posters of Barack Obama on their walls fade because they were sort of trapped in unemployment. And, of course, it's a cheap shot when you look at the big picture of the problems facing the millennial generation coming into the workforce now. There simply aren't the jobs, and many of them have been ripped off by this incredible for-profit college racket that's going on, where they get indentured with huge student debts and end up with worthless educations from these bogus universities that spend all of the taxpayers' money, which is what they live on promoting themselves and not providing any real education for these kids. A lot of them are vets, a lot of them are minorities. So, you know, we need to be having a debate, surely, about, you know, where are the new jobs going to come from?
Well, I think that's a good question, but I think that the fact is that it's not that we're waiting for certain industries and occupations to arise. We have a problem of a recession caused by a financial crisis, caused by deregulation of the kind the Republicans supported and some Democrats supported, that basically followed laissez-faire economics. Unemployment is too high. We can do policies which, in fact, stimulate the economy to get more jobs. And we would get jobs back in all sorts of industries and occupations. The problem that young college graduates face is a real one. It also predates the current recession. Since the year 2000, if you look at the wages of college graduates in their 20s, they've been lower every year. And the wages and the benefits that are available in jobs that college graduates get, young college graduates, are far less likely to be able to get a job with employer-provided health care or employer-provided pensions. So this is a problem that predates President Obama. It is exacerbated, for sure, in the recession. I've got four kids between the ages of 22 and 32. So I can, you know, talk all about them, and many have had to stay at home in the intervening years. So, you know, this is a real problem, and it's an ongoing one, and it's only going to be fixed if, in fact, employers are competing for workers, unemployment is down, and they feel obligated to provide good pay and benefits.
Well, but the policies being proffered by the Republicans, the austerity policies, we've seen
will
what
only
that
exacerbate this problem.
We've seen what's happened in Europe.
Complete,
you know.
They're complete hypocrites. They've done nothing but try to block any attempt at providing jobs or even providing assistance to people who are out of work, blocking the ability of people to get unemployment insurance so they can help themselves and their families get through a very, very tough time. They're obviously hypocritical. The unemployment is far higher than anybody would want. It's far higher than I think was necessary. I think better policies on the part of the administration, but with a bit more help from the opposition, that we could have had a lot more policies. Listen, we have state and local governments that have been busy cutting back on employment. They're doing that because there's a recession and there's a lack of revenue. We could easily get back millions of jobs in both the public and private sector by just being able to reestablish the kinds of services that we used to be able to expect from local governments and state governments. Many other things could be done. We could be investing in infrastructure. We could be fixing the infrastructure of our schools. We could be doing much more on the energy independence, energy renewable fronts. We could even have government provide jobs directly to people like we did in the 1930s. I think if we did that, people would actually see the jobs that are being produced. I think the stimulus kind of policies the president pursued, I supported them. I think they were successful. But one of the things that's weak about that is that people can't trace when they themselves or a member of their family are actually benefiting from a job that's created because, you know, we have done certain things like give someone a tax cut, give aid to state and local government, or provide unemployment insurance so that people are spending. These are good things to do. I understand these as an economist. People don't observe how they actually translate into more jobs, even though they do.
Well, just in closing, Larry Michel, the economist William Lozonik, who does a lot of work on the nature of changing nature of our capitalism in terms of the financialization of our economy, which has benefited Wall Street and the CEOs, and their model is to extract wealth and concentrate it at the top, not to create wealth in the way that even the robber barons did. And even Henry Ford understood you had to pay your workers enough to buy your products. And I don't know how that can be changed. One of the things that Lozonik has suggested needs to be done is they've got to stop the ability of CEOs to buy back, these corporations to buy back their own stock, which is totally unproductive. And it just runs up the price of stock and allows the CEOs to write themselves these massive checks. And none of this money, these billions and trillions that the corporate America is sitting on, is being reinvested in plant and equipment and research and development. So it seems to me that, you know, we've been talking about what has to be done to improve the conditions for labor in this country. But a hell of a lot of it seems to be at the doorstep of this predatory and useless kind of form of capitalism that's taking over American capitalism.
Well, I do think that the financial sector is dominating the economy, and we can get at them by, in fact, levying a financial transactions tax so that everything that they basically do, a little bit of money goes to the government and helps us meet the deficit and support the spending that we need. It also would slow down all the transactions that really don't really help us. And, you know, people buying and selling things at a split second with computer programs doesn't really advance the cause of anybody but those people who are really living off of the rest of the private sector.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this Labor Day, Lawrence Michel.
Okay, well, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Michel, who's the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He's the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled Unions, Inequality, and Faltering Middle-Class Wages. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking with veteran labor journalist Sam Pizzagatti.
There once was a union maid. She never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff that made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called. When the company boys come around, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me.
What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you.
And on this Labor Day, of course, one always turns to reflect upon the condition of labor in this country and the condition of the representation of labor. And invariably, it ends up in a sort of lament at how the representation of unions in labor have diminished to the point now where they're about 6% of the public sector. And it's hard to understand how, pulling back at a broader picture, Sam, to see how money is so well organized in this country, but people aren't. And what's your, you know, off the top of your head, explanation for that?
Well, it certainly seems that way now. The labor, as you noted, the private sector trade union membership rate is now under 7%. It's higher in the public sector, but there are vast swatches of this country where there's virtually no union presence at all. But I think the thing to remember is that this is not a law of nature. This is not an eternal situation. That years ago, in the middle of the 20th century, we had a much more vibrant labor union, and that vibrant labor movement of the middle of the 20th century came out of a situation very much like our own today. You know, it's 2012, but it could be 1928 and 1929 in terms of the labor presence back then in the 1920s. Labor had gone through a period where the forces of money, big money, had essentially crushed the trade union movement inconsequence. But labor came back, and I think labor, the trade union movement, can once again come back.
In your article, Sam Pizzagatti, A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage, you point out that the minimum wage today, the federal minimum wage, is 7.25 cents an hour, and that back in 1968, the minimum wage workers took home $1.60 an hour. But if you adjust that for inflation, a minimum wage worker today would be earning $10.55 an hour by 1968 standards. So in effect, the minimum wage workers today are taking home almost $7,000 a year less than the minimum wage workers took home in 1968. That is definitely, you know, a sign of that we're not moving forward, right?
Yes, and in fact, I was a minimum wage worker in 1968, and I remember my paychecks with the $1.60 hourly wage, and it's striking to think how much more that wage in terms of real purchasing power back then was worth compared to the purchasing power of the minimum wage today. The last minimum wage hike took place in 2009, so essentially minimum wage workers have been losing ground to inflation ever since.
Well, in contrast, all the statistics indicate that the wealthy and the super wealthy have been making out like bandits, particularly since about 1980. Their share of the American pie has gotten so big that it's reached obscene proportions. For example, just one family, the Waltons, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, they own more wealth than the bottom 40% of all Americans.
That's right. And the Walmart CEO is making over 800 times the salary of the typical Walmart worker right now. We've seen an enormous redistribution of wealth up. One easy way to think about this is that since the late 1970s, the incomes of the top 1% have doubled after inflation. But if you look at the incomes of the top 1/10 of 1%, those have tripled after inflation since the late 1970s. And if you go up even higher to the top 1/100 of 1%, those incomes have more than quadrupled after inflation since the late 1970s.
Sam Pizzagatti, again, a veteran labor journalist, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. So we've just been witnessing last week the Republican convention in Tampa, Florida, and believe it or not, the call from the Republicans was that they've got to break unions, that the unions are too powerful, that they've got to rein them in. I mean, what planet? On their platform, it's all about weakening the power of unions. And we know Citizens United decision, even though it gives a nod to union money, there's no question that corporate money outstrips union money by, you know, probably a factor of 100. So
it's very interesting that if you look at the Republican platform for 2012, in the past, all the Republican platforms of recent years at least paid lip service to the value of collective bargaining. But this new platform pays no lip service to collective bargaining at all. It is a total anti-union platform and with no ifs, ands, and buts about it.
And that is obviously the pioneer, if you will, of this anti-public employee sector union movement is Governor Scott Walker, who spoke early at the convention.
Yes, and he was surrounded by a number of other governors who have taken almost as hardline stances against labor rights as he has.
But it still has the feeling, to me at least, Sam Pizzagatti, that it's a part of this whole kind of Republican boogeyman strategy to move the goalposts to the right all the time. You know, they've invented this myth of the liberal media. And, you know, I'm speaking to you from the Pacifica station in Los Angeles, and Pacifica is the liberal media, right? But it's, you know, very powerless and, you know, suffering from its own internal fratricide. So nobody can tell me that we have a powerful liberal media in this country. It's just a huge lie. And equally true, nobody can tell me that there's a powerful union movement with big union bosses, as the Republicans like to say, throwing their weight around. Is this just a part of that kind of cynical strategy of creating a bogeyman?
Yes, it certainly is. And we need to go beyond talking about the cynicism that we saw at the Republican convention and actually talk about the outright lies that came from the podium from a variety of speakers, lies about Medicare, lies about taxes, lies about all sorts of the things from convention speakers. You know, the Romney Ryan ticket is based on some very simple deceits, and I hope by the end of the campaign those will be very clear and plain to most of the American people.
And what do you think it is then that, just going back to my original question, Sam Pizzagatti, is why is it that money is so well organized and people don't appear to be? We know that the Republicans don't get elected unless they get Democrats to vote Republican, and that's this phenomenon known as the Reagan Democrat. And in many ways, it looks like Paul Ryan was chosen because he's been fairly consistently elected in a blue-collar district in Wisconsin, although it's not really that blue-collar, but at least it's not a traditional Republican safe seat. You know, and he, by the way, Ryan goes out of his way to talk about his union buddies and the people that worked in the factory that was closed, and the lie that he told about Obama closing a factory that happened during George W. Bush's watch. So he's definitely practiced at that. What do you think will reverse that phenomenon of the Reagan Democrat that is essential for a Republican victory?
Well, I think there are fewer and fewer Reagan Democrats across the United States. That I think the record of the last 30 years has made sort of clear to most white working class people that the Republican approach really offers no big gain, and I think the Republicans realize that too, and that's why, you know, so much of their effort is about mobilizing their base and suppressing as much of the rest of the vote as they can. I don't think they have a winning message any longer. I think people know what happens when we follow the precepts of trickle down. That doesn't work. People have seen it doesn't work. But we need to push in the other direction. And the recent article that I've done, A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage, talks about one of those directions. And that comes from Larry Hanley, who's the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, which is a national bus drivers union in the United States. He's calling for a maximum wage. He's calling for creating an income cap tied to the to the lowest wage, to the minimum wage, and I think that's a very exciting proposition. Just the sort of thing we need to do, need to talk about, to begin to reverse the situation that we have now. We need to capture people's imaginations. We need bold plans, and I think talking about a maximum wage tied to a minimum wage is a wonderful way to start doing that.
Well, there's no question that these corporate CEOs can literally write their own checks, and they do, and there's this phenomenon of buying back stock, which is entirely unproductive, but it results in CEOs being able to reward themselves with billions and billions of dollars. And as you point out in your article, Sam Pizzagatti, A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage, during World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt called for what amounted to a maximum wage when he urged Congress to place a 100% tax on incomes over $25,000 a year.
And the idea for that came from the CIO labor unions led by the United Auto Workers. The labor movement during World War II pushed Roosevelt on this, and he went along with the labor movement. And at one point, the Gallup opinion polls were showing a plurality of Americans supporting the idea of an income cap on the rich.
So give us some more details then of how a maximum wage would operate.
Well, there are different ways that a maximum wage could operate. You could say that you can create a 100% top marginal tax rate and tax all income over 10 or 50, 100 times the minimum wage at a 100% tax rate. If you did that, then the very rich in our society would have a vested personal interest in increasing the minimum wage, because the higher the minimum wage, then the higher the maximum wage threshold. So 100% tax is one way of going about that. There are other ways that we could take steps in that direction. We could say, for instance, that the government will sign no contracts with corporations that pay their top executives over 25 or 50 or 100 times what their lowest paid workers make. Every large corporation in the United States today depends to a significant degree on government contracts and subsidies. If we took those away, if we tied those to an internal corporate pay ratio, that would have a definite impact. We could also stop subsidizing excessive CEO pay. We could say that corporations will no longer be allowed to deduct off their paychecks any corporate compensation that's over 25 or 50, 100 times what their workers are making. And indeed, Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California has legislation pending called the Income Equity Act, which would do just that. Her legislation would prevent corporations from deducting off their corporate income taxes any corporate compensation, corporate executive compensation, that runs over 25 times the pay of a company's lowest paid worker.
So, Sam Pizzagatti, how would you deal with the capital gains and the carried interest, which is how Mitt Romney has gotten so rich and pays so little taxes? And that applies, of course, to the hedge fund managers, clearly because we have a political system based on money, and the power of money has been able to essentially buy Capitol Hill. And so they've written the tax laws to benefit themselves, where, you know, they get paid, you know, 15% for capital gains and carried interest. In some cases, they don't pay any taxes at all. And as you know, Mitt Romney has not been particularly forthcoming about his taxes, so we don't quite know about the many years that he hasn't disclosed.
That's right.
So how do you deal with that?
Well, it's very simple. Capital income from capital gains should be, and capital gains are the profits you make when you sit, buy, and sell assets, stocks and bonds and gold or whatever. Those profits that you get, the income you make from the buying and selling of assets, should be subject to the same tax rate as wage labor. There should be no special preferential treatment from capital gains. And indeed, when the U.S. Federal income tax first started, there was no special treatment for capital gains.
So the long and the short of it is, what will it take to get your proposal here, a bold new call for a maximum wage enacted and changes to the capital gain structure?
It'll take what it took to create middle-class America of the mid-20th century, and that's a strong labor movement, a revitalized labor movement. And here on Labor Day, it's a great time to rededicate ourselves to the task. Until we have a stronger labor movement in the United States, until we build that stronger labor movement, we're not going to have any sort of real significant social progress.
But as you were saying earlier, Sam Pizzagatti, that labor was reduced down to next to nothing before the Great Depression, and then it was built back up as a result of the Great Depression and the policies of FDR. Is that to say that since we're in the Great Recession and perhaps even on the brink of a new depression, is that what it's going to take?
Well, it could be. You know, I'm always an optimist, and I hope we don't need to fall into an even deeper recession than we're in now. You know, we'll see. Again, on Labor Day, what better time than this to think about and to start working toward a strong, vital labor presence in the United States?
Well, Sam Pizzagatti, I thank you so much for joining us on this Labor Day.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, who's a veteran labor journalist and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's the editor of the online newsletter Too Much, and his most recent article is A Bold New Call for a Maximum Wage. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.